We've been talking about how communities across Illinois are having conversations about race, policing, and violence. Today we hear from another Midwestern community in Wichita, where a cookout between police and the community got national attention.
I believe that what we did with the cookout was very integral in some of the change that we're looking to bring about into this community. But again, it was just the first step, and I believe that we do have a long way to go.
We talked with the organizer behind the Wichita group, I Got Your Back. Also, Minnesota native J. Ryan Strottle doesn't really like the term foodie.
I guess I'm a food enthusiast. I feel a lot of affection towards the food of my upbringing, but I quite often don't eat that way.
We speak with the author about his debut novel. It's a foray into the food and culture of Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. And the financial state of McDonald's, that's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether it's walleye, Lutheran church bake-offs, or chili contests in Chicago bars, the peculiar eating and cooking habits of our region are woven throughout the novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest. The debut work by author J. Ryan Strottle isn't just out in paperback. He's going to be speaking about his book this evening at the Champaign Public Library, but he's here with us now. Hey, J. Ryan.
Hi, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
The central character of this novel is Eva. She's a young woman with a once-in-a-generation palate. And through her, we learn a lot about not just Minnesota, but Iowa and Wisconsin. And there's a little bit of Chicago in this. Where did Eva come from? How did you come up with this character?
Oh, wow. A lot of Eva is sort of wish fulfillment on my part. I feel like Eva is the kind of person I wanted to be at many of the stages of her life that I represent in the novel. You know, when she's 11, she gets back at the bullies that are picking on her on the bus. I did not get to do that. She gets to do that.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
Right. She discovers her talent early and really takes ownership of it and asserts it as a career a lot earlier than I did. You know, she's just one of those people that people looked at in her community and said, okay, this girl knows exactly what she's good at, what she wants. And we've all known people like that. They're not terribly common, but, you know, there are certainly, you know, people that you've seen when they were 8 years old. You know, that kid's going to be, you know, a firefighter or, an acrobat. And it turns out that they are 20 years later. And she's just one of those kids. And I really admired that in her. That decisiveness and that consistency of vision and the confidence that develops because of that. But as she became a chef, I did rely on a few friends for information and personality notes and tone and experience. But yeah, she's not really based on any one person other than the kind of person I want to be, even now.
Well, and I love that one scene that you talk about in the beginning of the book. It's when I think you really get to start to see a little bit of her personality, because she's sort of like this very calm, but she really knows who she is, right? And there's this scene where she's really young and she's on the bus, and I don't even know if bullied is the right word because it's so terrible the stuff they're doing to her, but she has this great revenge that she enacts on everybody. And you kind of alluded to this. I imagine that was a little wish fulfillment on your part of this is, it's such a great way that she gets back at these terrible kids. I feel like they really, it's, I don't know if they deserve what happens to them, but it's certainly completely understandable.
Sure. Yeah, it's a very personal way that she gets back at them, and personal to her. I mean, she exacts the kind of revenge that only she could conceive of and execute. Like, it's very specific to her skill set. I don't want to say anything else.
No, we'll leave that because...
Spoiler alert. But
well, and what I love about this is that, so there's Eva, and she's sort of the person who the novel is about and around her, but then there's all these different people and these different stories, and then they all kind of end up converging in the end. There's a couple different storylines, and I wonder, when you're doing a novel like that, did you start with Eva? Did you start with all these other characters? Because there's this entire world that really does go across the Midwest and lots of different people and occupations. How did you sketch that out in your head?
I'd started with the menu. Well, I knew what the ending of the book was before I started writing it. I knew what I was working
on.
So toward.
You started with the final menu. We're not going to give anything away, but yeah. You started with the final menu at the end of the book. Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
And the final menu is populated with ingredients that the reader becomes acquainted with throughout the book. So I kind of retrofitted a narrative to build to that menu. I knew that I wanted to tell a story of these ingredients entering Eva's life at different points in her life. And I had to consider who would introduce her to these ingredients and why and at what points in her life. To me, it felt like a recipe for a human, a recipe for a girl who becomes a confident woman, and a recipe for a chef. And I felt like structuring the narrative that way felt intuitive and corresponded really nicely with the content in the story. Especially as Eva gets more famous, you hear less from her. There's more conjecture, there's more rumor, there's more myth, and I like that. I think that helps create a sense of Eva's legend. By the time you accompany the final point of view character to Eva's dinner, I think you feel as, or I do as a reader, and I did as a writer, I felt as estranged from Eva at that point as the reader does, and so it becomes a really wonderful way to discover who this woman's become. It was a lot of fun to write, too. I just woke up every day and wrote the exact part I wanted to write. I didn't start at the beginning, you know, knowing what I was planning to do. I just woke up every day and wrote the exact ingredients or the exact person I felt like writing that day. And wrote everything completely out of order, yeah.
Oh, wow. So you wrote everything out of order, and then you put it all together at the end?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when did you write the first chapter?
Oh, I think third to last.
Wow. Okay.
And then I knew what I was setting up. You know, I knew what the first chapter had to do. I just really put it off. I didn't want to spend too much time rendering it overly precious and really trying to impress myself or others with like an incredibly amazing first sentence or paragraph or first page. Like a lot of authors, I have a manuscript that will never see the light of day, a novel that I wrote in my 20s. And one of the mistakes I made in writing that novel was starting at the beginning because I spent too long, wasted too much time stressing over having a really impressive opening.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
So this time I put it off. I said, you know what, I know what the beginning has to do. It's about Eva's parents, how they meet, Eva's early infancy and childhood. Yeah, I'll put it off. I'll get to that once the rest of her life is spelled out, and then I'll know what I have to say. then the beginning kind of writes itself, and that's how it turned out. Yeah, I really felt like writing this way made for a fun and real energetic and often joyous writing experience. I really got a lot of joy writing this book. It made me really happy to write, and I hope that comes through.
Yeah. I'm speaking with J. Ryan Straddle. He's the author of Kitchens of the Great Midwest, which came out last year, just recently came out in paperback. And did you grow up in Minnesota?
Yeah, I did.
There's so much food. There's food from Minnesota. There's food from Iowa. There's food from Illinois. And I want to get to all of the food in a minute. But I wanted to ask you about, as we've been talking about how you wrote it, there are a lot of very dramatic turns in this. There's a very, I found, unexpected end to the first chapter, but I liked it. I was like, okay, I don't know where we're going from here. There's another scene where after one baking contest, the police kind of show up and you're just, wow, you're kind of surprised. So I read that you, in your other job, you produce a couple of reality shows.
Yeah, spent most of my time in California, where I currently live, working in television and often in unscripted television. I worked on shows like Deadliest Catch and Knights Road Truckers, worked on the Storage Wars franchise. And yeah, that's been quite a educational experience from a story perspective.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Because do you feel like part of producing a reality show, I imagine, is creating that dramatic element within a reality setting? Did that have an influence on you as a writer in sort of a fictional way, just sort of these very kind of very dramatic moments that happen?
Well, I think in a structural way, absolutely. It becomes a lot harder to tell a story when you don't get to make any of it up. like, you know, with Deadliest Catch, for example, either they catch the crab or they don't. Either way, you have to tell the story.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Even if we really want them to catch the crab.
I was going to say, I always think reality shows are so much more produced than that.
Some are, yeah. And in the past, I've worked on some that are really heavily produced. But the Deadliest Catch or Ice for Truckers were following around people that were already doing these jobs. And for the most part, they grudgingly allow us to come along. And discern the narratives within their lives. And when you're discerning a narrative within something that doesn't have a lot of opportunities for closure or really obvious resolutions, you know, there's just habits or there's practices that are regular. So you look for variations within those, and you're constantly looking for act breaks. You know, where can we stop this story halfway through to, in such a way to incite interest in the continuation of the story. You know, you're really looking through something, trying to find, you know, beginnings and endings in a life that doesn't have them.
I was also wondering about the reality show. I love the descriptions of characters in this book. And there's one that I just wanted to read about Lacey, to just give people a sense. Actually, I wonder, can you read it?
Yeah, hold on. I've actually never read this part aloud.
Okay.
Lacey was a glow of color and happiness that no one besides her husband ever wanted. She was upbeat and harmless as an educational toy, and it was never insincere. In fact, she was a one-woman plague of sincerity, the patient zero of earnest zeal.
I wondered, did you write these descriptions of people that you would have loved to have on a reality show, or where did you...
Oh, no, I wasn't literally thinking about reality TV much when I was writing the novel. I was mostly thinking of the kinds of people I grew up with in Minnesota and knew in the Midwest, knew in North Dakota and Wisconsin, Iowa and Illinois, other places I've spent a lot of time. Yeah, when it came to describing people in a succinct way, I think my reality TV lessons came to play again. You know, certainly you only have about 43 minutes to tell the story of a single episode of Deadliest Catch or Ice Road Truckers, and you have to be pretty concise in your descriptions to fit in a lot of story content. I find the descriptive and narrative lessons from unscripted television, to be pretty useful to me as a writer.
So I'm curious about you said that a lot of these characters are from people that you've met in your life growing up in the Midwest and then living all over. How long have you been gone from the Midwest?
Oh, wow. I moved to Los Angeles in 1998.
Okay, so a long time.
And even though almost 20 years. Even though I go back regularly, usually about 5 times a year to Minnesota.
Okay.
Yeah, haven't been a resident there in quite a while. It is really important to me to stay in touch with my family and to see them as often as possible. I talk to my dad and my grandmother every week. I stay with my brother every time I go back. And those three people are very different types of people than I am. It's always a really wonderful experience to get to hang out with them and get to see and really interact with the world they participate in. It's not much like the world I grew up in. You know, town I grew up in.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. It's still a wonderful town. I mean, I have friends who I went to high school with that are now raising their children there and will be sending them to the same high school. And I think that's great. I think that it speaks to the value of that community, but at the same time, I feel like a lot of writers do. I think my first book was about my childhood, whether if I meant it to be or not. I think, I heard that's a bit of a cliche, and unfortunately, I found myself walking into it, but when I realized that, I didn't resist it. I thought, okay, I'm writing about things the way I remember them, you know, and not everyone's going to agree with me. Some people are going to say I overrepresented or underrepresented certain things, and that's fine. But these are the types of people and the types of situations that I need to tell this story. And maybe in my next novel or in future novels, I'll tell other stories. But for now, I felt like, you know, I'm writing about a Midwest that in a lot of ways, you know, has since evolved. A lot of the restaurants, for example, I wrote about don't exist anymore.
I also think it's a Midwest that it's a really interesting thing because I think you're writing about the Midwest from the perspective and with the affection as well as the eye of someone who has left that place.
Yeah, right, right. But it's not just nostalgia. There's an awful lot of people in the Midwest that, you know, who I didn't agree with at the time or whose company I didn't enjoy.
Well, and I think you can see that, you can see those characters, right, in the book. And I appreciate I can't believe we've actually gotten this far and we haven't really talked about food, but I appreciate the different food personalities that are in this book, because there's a lot of poking fun at foodie culture, but then there's also poking fun at the people who completely reject that. And I think this probably comes to a head most in a scene where this longtime winner of her church bake-off and her town bake-off goes to St. Paul or to Minneapolis, to the big city, for like this big city bake-off and this big competition. And everybody thinks that her son is the one, first of all, everyone thinks her son's the one in the competition because they can't imagine that this older church lady is involved in this culinary competition. And then my favorite line is when they ask her where her ingredients, if they're locally sourced, and she says, yeah, I got them from the supermarket like a mile from my house. And then they all just sort of start laughing at her. So I would take it from this that just from the reading of it, I don't know if you're what your relationship to food is. If you probably, I don't know if you like the term foodie, if you hate that term.
Yeah, I don't really care either way. I guess I'm a food enthusiast, you know.
We're going to have to take a break when we come back. So, Jay Ryan, if you hold on, we're going to take a break and continue this conversation with Jay Ryan Straddle. He's the author of Kitchens of the Great Midwest. He's speaking this evening at the Champaign Public Library at 7 o'clock. Stay tuned. We're going to continue this conversation with Jay Ryan in just a minute. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Jay Ryan Straddle. He's the author of Kitchens of the Great Midwest. He's speaking this evening at the Champaign Public Library. Jay Ryan, just before the break, we were talking about food. Can you continue? You were saying you're a food enthusiast.
I feel a lot of affection towards the food of my upbringing, but I quite often don't eat that way. It's been a while since I've made a hot dish. I mean, I made them when I was writing the book to, you know, get into the mood.
Do you cook a lot?
Yeah, from time to time, but usually pretty simple stuff. You know, I like fish and vegetables and rice. You know, I'm not a terribly complicated chef here. I'm not trying to, win awards for my recipes. But that said, I try to eat healthy and local, and I put thought into what I put into my body, and certainly I enjoy the agricultural agility of a state like California. It's really fun to move to a place like this and see fruits that I didn't see growing up. But that said, you know, there's an awful lot of really wonderful agriculture and food and drink in Minnesota and in the upper Midwest. And when I go back, I make a point out of experiencing something new and going to new places that are trying new things. Just last month when I was in town, when I was in Minnesota, I went to a distillery called Panther, which is up near Alexandria in north central Minnesota. And it's really wonderful to watch them make whiskey and rye and bourbon out of local corn and then send the used corn mash back to local farms to feed cows. And it's really cool to see a distillery be a segment of a agricultural ecology like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful that the laws in that state are finally relaxed enough to allow for that kind of thing. There's just a James Beard Award winner in Minneapolis. There's a vegan butcher in Minneapolis now. There's all kinds of great evolutions in food happening all through the Midwest. And of course, Chicago is a world-class food city for a number of reasons. And it's not just, you know, the exclusivity or the expense of some of the top-of-the-line food establishments, but also the personality you know, everyone knows what a Chicago dog and what a deep dish pizza is.
Well, I'm thinking about the exclusivity of Chicago food. And in the book, you have Eva evolves into having these pop-up supper clubs where people end up paying sort of these seemingly astronomical prices for her meals, which frankly are pretty similar to certain chefs in Chicago and a ticketing system that happens. And what I appreciate is the way that you describe how people, the sort of hysteria and rapture that people go into when they're having her meal. And it's a little absurd the way that people react. But I guess my question is, why do you think we're so passionate about food?
Wow. That's a really great question. I don't think I can speak for everyone. I'm passionate about food because, to me, I don't think we've ever been at a point in my lifetime where, as a culture, we've had the access and ability to enjoy such a wide variety of it. And we're so engaged with ways to make it interesting and not just functional or tasty, you know, but actually reasonable within the constraints of seasons and locale. In other words, like, you can eat local and wonderfully, like, healthy and delicious. And it's really cool to be, you know, to be living in a time where we have access to that kind of information, where we can, you know, where there's an interest in people gardening, eating things out of their garden, eating things from the local farmer, you know, from farmers markets, combining them, and, you know, eating well and within the constraints of a budget, too. I remember, you know, in the 90s, I knew a lot of vegetarians in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. And back then, eating vegetarian was quite a bit more of a challenge. And sometimes if you went to a vegetarian restaurant as well, it was no small expense. You know, it seemed to me like, oh, you could eat vegetarian for a lot cheaper than it seems. In this city I live in now, there's still neighborhoods that don't have easy access to fresh fruit and vegetables, or their fresh fruit and vegetable sections, even in their local grocery stores, are pathetic compared to what the, you know, the state could potentially supply them with. And I feel like now we live in a time where I think it's probably never been easier or cheaper to eat well. And we're still kind of evolving a sensibility of apprehending that. And hopefully it becomes even cheaper and easier. One of the things that's always kind of disgusted me about foodies and about the foodie movement is the expense and is both the expense and the, I don't know what the right noun is, like the clubbish attitude to it.
The sanctimonious attitude, would that be?
Exactly. It takes both money and a certain kind of recondite knowledge, you know, to even access it. Like, you have to be in the know, or, you know, and the foodie restaurants are usually clustered in, you know, more expensive neighborhoods or hipper neighborhoods. And there's a certain air of exclusivity to it at times. And, you know, I've always admired seeing, you know, good food served in a much less pretentious environment and a much more accessible environment. And I think we're moving in that direction. I mean, you shouldn't have to be rich or be snobby to, you know, eat tofu.
Well, and you poke fun at a lot of this, and particularly when we're thinking about food and also the jargon that goes with food. There's a great scene where they're in Southern California at a vineyard, and it's kind of this typical, and I have experienced these people at vineyards, and I thought they were a joke until I went to Napa, but the people who are sort of the people who are, I'm the wine, I'm the person who can afford to buy all this wine, and I'm going to be kind of a jerk about it when I'm in a tasting room. And so that character kind of pops up in the book, but I also really appreciate when there's also part of the book where everybody, there's a club where people are competing with each other and making food. And one woman says she brings an heirloom tomato, and they have an argument about what variety of heirloom tomato this is, because Eva actually tells her, oh, yeah, that's a genetically engineered. That's not heirloom, that variety that you're talking about. So you have a lot of really specific information in here about about corn and when corn turns sweet, like all of the science of the food. Did you do that research yourself, or is that something that you? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I spent a lot of time researching this book. A few things I knew already. I've been a wine fan. I don't want to say enthusiast or connoisseur. I can't afford to be a connoisseur. I'm a wine fan. I was looking for a good bottle under $20. But in any case, other than the wine information, I felt like I was coming in cold to a lot of things. I spent some time with friends who were heirloom tomato enthusiasts in Portland. Yeah, I basically spent time talking with anyone who grew anything related to this book. I went to the locations in the book, the ones that still exist. You know, I took a lot of pictures. I talked to people. I did my best to, you know, to make it seem accurate, even if the book in general has a slightly heightened tone to it, in terms of, you know, things sort of existing on the precipice of magical realism at points.
Yeah, there's just a little bit of that, which is, I think.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. Yeah, but overall, I sometimes feel flattered when people walk up to me and they say things like, "Oh, that restaurant you talked about in Chicago, The Truth. I've been there. I know that place." And I think, no, you haven't. That place doesn't exist. I made it up. I mean,
but maybe that's really funny, though, because I think that's what you're getting at with, as we think about, we are in this weird moment of juxtaposition. And I actually think you may even see it more starkly in the Midwest than you do on coasts, where in like a New York or an L.A., there's so much healthy eating that is very, like, you go to Brooklyn and like everything is locally sourced and sustained and organic, or, but it's expensive.
And it's all $16.
Exactly. Yeah, and so it's an interesting, I wonder from an outsider's perspective, someone who grew up in the Midwest, now been away for some time, but comes back. I wonder what your perspective is of where you think we're at, of a place where we've grown a lot of this food for the rest of the country for such a long time. Mm. I wonder where you think we're at with being people who make food that's local and sustainable, but still affordable and not pretentious. I mean, do you think that we are getting to a place where we can do that more outside of big cities?
It seems like it. One of the things that the dilation of food culture has brought us through magazines and TV shows and books is more awareness of this. You know, anyone with a TV set now, you know, can get recipes, you know, can get exposure to recipes and methods that would have seemed really difficult to access 25 years ago. We've come a long way in terms of disseminating information, you know, through the internet in particular. You can find a recipe for anything. And it's really, really cool to see people take advantage of that. Because frankly, anywhere you can get those ingredients, you can make that food. And a lot of people are waking up to the information that, oh, a lot of these ingredients are local. Yeah, I mean, when I was in Minnesota just last month, I was talking to a distiller at the distillery I visited, and she was telling me that there's a hops farm, you know, outside of St. Cloud that's going to be growing hops for local beer. You know, that there's this interest in farm to fork in all aspects of eating and drinking. And consumers like it. I think people have a certain amount of local pride in knowing, oh, wow, this potato or this beer comes from a place that I've been to. Like, I can visualize it. I'm from here. And so is this beer, you know. It's cool to know that you can have that kind of relationship with what you're eating or drinking. And yeah, as you implied, I just hope that we move increasingly away from this kind of food and drink being accessible only to hipsters and people with money. Because I don't know, I see in my own family, my dad's not a hipster. He probably doesn't know what the term locavore means, but he is one. You know, he very stridently eats local agricultural products. He gets all of his chicken from one particular local farmer outside of his town, and I really admire him for it, but he's just doing what he thinks is healthy and tastes good. You know, he's not thinking too hard about whether or not it's cool. He's not blogging about it. He's not taking pictures of it and putting them on Instagram.
He's not Instagramming all of his meals. Yeah.
Exactly. No. He wouldn't consider it. Yeah, I think he would find it perverted. He's just a guy that likes good food, and he's taken advantage of the farms and local growers and local small businesses that are making them accessible, you know, even in his area. And why not? I think it's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, there's a really great book that came out at the end of last year called In Winter's Kitchen by a Minnesota chef named Beth Dooley, and it's all about local agriculture in the upper Midwest. And she names names. She talks about very specific local farms and cheesemongers and wild rice growers and how they do what they do and how long they've been doing it for and where you can get their stuff. And I bought that book for my dad, and he said, oh, I know a lot of this already.
He said, I'm already shopping. He said, I don't need a book to find these places.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from people? So the book's been out for a year now. The paperback just came out a month or so ago. What kind of feedback have you gotten from people in your hometown in Minnesota or throughout the Midwest about the book?
For the most part, they seem pretty happy about it. I'm glad. When you write a book, you're always afraid that someone is going to misconstrue something or see themselves where you didn't intend them to see themselves, or see themselves in a negative light where you didn't intend for them to see themselves at all. And I don't have any characters in this book that are 100% based on any one person, and I don't draw a lot of direct correlations between the people in my life and the characters, but, you know, you can't control that. Certainly there are people that have come out of the woodwork and said, oh, I know you based this character on me, or did you base this character
on me? Was I the bully in your...
Yeah. Right, no.
You're never going to hear from them, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, as memoirists like to say, they should have behaved better. they wanted to be written about better. I felt like I've been pretty lucky so far in terms of the people in my hometown, for the most part, liking the book. The biggest pushback I've received on it is due to the language. There's a couple characters that are pretty salty.
That's true. Yeah, there is a lot of...
Yeah, and that's consistent to my experience growing up in my family in Minnesota. We had a few family members that are, you know, pretty R-rated in their dialogue. And I felt like I wanted to represent that, but certainly not everyone likes to see that as a representation of Midwesterners, or they want to, you know, it's still a barrier to entry for a number of readers in terms of their enjoyment of a book. And I get that. You know, I know that my grandma didn't enjoy a few chapters very much. And, you know, that's okay. I felt like I had to represent those characters honestly in terms of their voice.
You thank your grandma. Speaking of your grandmother, you thank her in the credits for a church cookbook that she gave you. How much of a role did that play in the recipes that you have in the book?
Well, quite a bit. The majority of the recipes are inspired by recipes from that church cookbook from my great-grandmother's church that my grandmother attended and my great-aunt attended until recently. That book was in our kitchen growing up. Mm. We made recipes from it, and it was quite an anchor, you know, when you think about also bridging generations. There are recipes in that book, and I know this for a fact because I have an older edition. I have a 1969 edition as well that haven't changed in decades. And it was really cool to sit here in my kitchen, you know, in 2013, when I was writing the first draft of the novel and making something that my great-grandmother had made 50 years before, the exact same way. And I really enjoyed grounding aspects of this novel in those Midwestern food traditions, especially at a time when we seem to be culturally moving away from them with such alacrity. I really wanted to reconcile the kind of food I grew up with in the upper Midwest with the food we're seeing now. I mean, I know in Illinois you have a really, really awesome state fair. And we do in Minnesota as well. And a lot of the food at these state fairs are guilty pleasure foods, and they really celebrate local agriculture. And I like that kind of stuff as much as I like heirloom tomatoes. Yeah, and it's fun to try to have it both ways. And my character Eva really tried to have a character that was rooted in Midwestern food traditions, but also was a food enthusiast and locavore and modern chef and the most contemporary fashion of that term. So yeah, I felt like that recipe book was extremely important to me in terms of being one of the foundational pillars of the novel.
The novel is Kitchens of the Great Midwest. Its author, J. Ryan Straddle, is going to be speaking this evening at the Champaign Public Library at 7 o'clock. The event is part of Reading is So Delicious, the library's summer series for grown-ups. J. Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for listening.
Welcome Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When fast food giant McDonald's brought in a new CEO and launched its all-day breakfast menu last year, business quickly picked up. But is the honeymoon over for Steve Easterbrook? McDonald's is, of course, one of Illinois' largest public companies. And quarterly results released yesterday, weak sales and the forecast sent its share price down almost 4%. And the stock's trading below yesterday's close right now. We're joined by Joe Cahill, who reported on this issue yesterday for Crain Chicago Business. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Sure, I'm glad to be here.
Joe, I thought the all-day breakfast menu was supposed to save everything. What happened with the results yesterday?
Well, the results showed that the growth benefit of all-day breakfast is starting to fade. It gave the company a real charge last year when they introduced it, but that's kind of a one-time thing, and as they start to lap the quarters after they had introduced it, then the growth rate will begin to slow. Compounding that is a general slowdown in the restaurant industry. People are starting to eat out less, and that's affecting McDonald's and all the other fast food companies.
Yeah, so Joe, that people eating out less is also, McDonald's has been in a pretty tough place with that recently, right? Because everyone kind of, if they are eating out, they're going to more fast casual chains like Chipotle. What is McDonald's doing to try to resurrect that?
Well, the all-day breakfast was a big part of it. I mean, that was something that their customers had wanted for generations, and they finally provided it. And they're trying to be more sensitive to the market, giving local restaurant managers more flexibility with the menu. They've whittled down the menu in general because it had gotten too overcrowded, and they're sharpening their marketing, and they've tried to streamline the bureaucracy of the company to enable them to make decisions faster.
And Joe, it's important to point out sales were actually up 1.8%, but it was less than market expectations. And what was the forecast?
Well, it was right. I mean, the rate of growth slowed down, particularly in the U.S. That 1.8% same-store sales growth was the U.S. number. Analysts had been expecting 3.2%, and in the first quarter, the U.S. sales grew 5.4%, and that was a dramatic slowdown, and that raised a lot of concerns. And the outlook is that it will continue to slow down.
Joe, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for McDonald's. Again, quarterly results yesterday weaker than analysts expected. And as Joe says, we'll see what happens next time around with McDonald's, one of our largest public companies. Thanks to Joe Cahill with Crain Chicago Business for that. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about conversations that are happening not just in Illinois, but across the country around race, policing, and violence. We wanted to turn to another Midwestern community now to hear about how they've been handling things. AJ Bohannon is the founder of I Got Your Back in Wichita, Kansas. 2 weeks ago, more than 2,000 community members and law enforcement members participated in a joint barbecue. It was supposed to be a Black Lives Matter protest until the Wichita chief of police reached out and suggested a cookout. You've probably seen this all over social and national media. We wanted to check in with AJ now to follow up on that moment and see what impact it's had on the community. AJ Bohannon joins us from Wichita. AJ, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
AJ, before we get to how things are now, I want to ask you what your first reaction was when you first heard from the police asking if they could do a barbecue with you guys.
My reaction was that it was something that this community could really benefit from. There's a great divide in this community, in this town, with the police officers and the citizens here, who wanted to try to do something that was going to be able to bridge the gap. We had did a protest prior to the event that we did with the barbecue. We did a protest prior to that. And the whole reason behind that is we wanted to try to just provide a controlled grieving session, and we wanted everybody's voices to be heard. By them reaching out the very next day after that protest, we knew that we had accomplished our goal of having our voices heard. Now that we were able to sit down at the table, we wanted to try to come up with some things that would be conducive to getting a solution that we were looking for. But we just, it wasn't about the cookout. There were some question and answer sessions going on there as well for about an hour and a half that allowed, you know, the citizens to ask the chief of police himself direct questions, in which he gave direct answers to. And I think that that was big as well.
Yeah, and AJ, I think everyone's seen, or a lot of people have maybe seen the social media of people dancing, of police officers in the community doing like the whip or the nay nay. But as you said, there were some pretty raw conversations that also took place. What was shared at that in that moment?
Well, here in our town, you know, we've been looking to get an independent prosecutor because some of these police-involved officer shootings, they've been tried by the DA here, who I have you know, the utmost respect for. But in a situation where you have an officer who kills a member of this society or this community, and the officer is, you know, has this, a lawyer, and a friend, the lawyer is probably friends with the judge. They probably went to law school together, and the judge is probably, you know, golf buddies with the DA. They're all in the same bed. I mean, it creates a really hostile environment and a hostile situation to try to have somebody defend them, knowing that they all have, you know, some certain ties to each other. So what we want to do is we want to try to get somebody from the outside to come in, outside DA to come in and look at those cases, you know, independent prosecutor. As well as that, we're looking at some cultural diversity training, some cultural competency training here to implement into our police. Force. It's obvious here that some of the training that they need in order to interact with the people in our community is lacking or missing. And then we're looking at a independent, we're looking at a citizens review board with subpoena power as well. When a lot of complaints are made in this town, they're heard by, you know, people on the force, and it's hard for a friend to accuse a friend of any crime. So we want to look at getting that done as well. So there were a lot of hard-pressed questions that were asked. Like I said, it was an hour and a half.
Of questions? An hour and a half of questions, AJ?
We did about an hour and a half question and answer session. So there were about 15 questions that were probably asked.
Wow, that's a pretty significant conversation. I know yesterday you were meeting with the chief of police of Wichita. Now that it's been a week or so, I imagine a lot of the national media maybe has subsided. But I want to ask where you think those conversations are going now. It sounds like you have very clear things you've been asking the police that the community would like to see happen.
The police chief has verbally agreed to back all of the things that we're looking at, which is a great you know, accomplishment, because we've never had anybody that holds that high of an office actually not only listen to but agree with and support some of the things that we've been trying to do here in this town. So we're taking great strides in that area. The meeting with him yesterday was specifically geared around one certain thing in this town, which is called the gang file. The list of things that you can do to get on that file are so extensive. You really don't know what you've probably done to get on that list. But once you get on that list, you have a 3-year grace period to where before you can come off. So, you know, those are the things that we're looking at. That meeting yesterday was simply geared around the gang file. And it's a very aged, you know, documented list. It needs to be refined and retuned. Do we need to do away with it? Probably not. But do we need to look into it and see what we can do better? Because there are some people on there that deserve to be off that should have been off a long time ago. So that meeting was geared towards that one thing, and that's I don't believe that every state has that. I know it's a law here in the state of Kansas, but we're looking to really try to have some pushback on some of those things that are within that certain document so we can get those changed as well.
AJ, I know you have two personal stories of your family and police involvement, and I wonder what your personal experience is with the Wichita Police, how that sort of colors all of your work and these conversations that you're having right now.
Yes. 4 years ago, I was about 3 feet away from my cousin when he was shot and killed downtown in our entertainment area by the Wichita Police Department. There was an altercation that occurred, and he was labeled the individual that was shooting downtown because he had on the same color shirt as the individual they had identified over the radio. My cousin would not have ever in a million years done anything that they accused him of doing. And we were just like everybody else trying to get away from the mayhem. And he was picked out and shot 5 times in his back as he was running away. And I witnessed that. And that's something that image that I'll carry with me forever. You know, sitting there watching him take his last breath is something that really haunts me. But I knew that there would have to be something that I could do with all of that resentment and all that anger. I tried to turn my frown upside down and try to do the things in this community, you know, that we could try to prevent some future things like that happening. So I took my efforts, and that's when I started IGYB, which stands for I've Got Your Back, because it was a message to my family. My family was grieving. It was a message to my community, because there have been several different instances in this community that have happened that have left families grieving. So IGYB is a message to my family and my community and my state, and hopefully one day, you know, the nation, that it can grow into something large and, you know, let everybody know it's a message. Like, hey, I got your back. You know, when things like this happen. After the Trayvon Martin protest, I was leaving a protest here in Wichita the day they had the nationwide protest day, and I was leaving the protest. I had on a black hoodie, and I had a sign around my neck on a shoestring that said, if I don't stand for something, then I'll fall for anything. And I went to the mall, and I was really pretty much harassed by a couple of patrons there that took, you know, some kind of defense into what I had on. And they began to say things, you know, that were really, you know, not called for. So the police were called, and the police asked me to remove the sign, and I let them know, hey, you know, this is not a protest sign. I have this on a shoestring around my neck, so that makes it an accessory. It's like a necklace. You know, I did my research and everything like that, so this is a necklace. So if I have to take this off, everybody in the mall that has on a necklace, they have to remove theirs as well. He took some defense to that because he was not looking forward to having an intellectual conversation. Mm. So he began to use his muscle and things like that, and I was arrested for trespassing. It was just like, and that went really viral here around this town and around the Midwest, because it was a situation where I had not done anything wrong. But those two things really drove me to push for change, because there was a lot of energy within this town, and I always wanted to use that energy and turn it into something positive, and that's what we were able to do.
That said, using that energy and turning into something positive, do you feel like, I can't imagine what you've gone through. It sounds like there's been so much that you've experienced personally, but I wonder if you feel like you're at a point now where you are not just yourself, but also the community, folks in Wichita who are both involved with the Black Lives Matter movement, but then also with the Wichita police. Do you feel like this is a moment where you all really are talking to each other now and things have turned a corner?
Yes, we are. And I just want to, before we continue, I just want to say, so we're not officially Black Lives Matter. I don't know if you've seen all the backlash that we've gotten from Washington, D.C. and the people in California as well. So we share some of the same issues that they do, and we definitely work towards some of the same goals. But we're not an official Black Lives Matter chapter.
Right, and I know they're not awarding official chapters right now. We actually had that conversation with someone from Springfield yesterday. But would you all say that you're affiliated with the Black Lives Matter movement? Would that be accurate?
No, we're not even affiliated. Like I said, we share some of the same goals, and we definitely are pressing towards some of the same issues, but we are not affiliated with them. But we just believe that Black Lives Matter, and we go about looking at some of those issues, and we go about trying to figure out some of those problems and solving some of those issues and bringing about solutions in a different
way.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, well, thanks for that clarification. That said, do you feel like your group, I Got Your Back, the other folks in your community in Wichita, do you feel like you all are in a good dialogue with the police and law enforcement and others in Wichita?
Most definitely. And the biggest thing about that, we named that cookout the first step cookout, because in any journey, you cannot start any journey, or you cannot go down a new path without taking that first step. I believe that what we did with the cookout was very integral into some of the change that we're looking to bring about into this community. But again, it was just the first step, and I believe that we do have a long way to go. I believe that everything that we're looking to accomplish is definitely within our reach. We just have to continue not to only take the first step, but now the second, third, fourth, and fifth steps have to be just as powerful and just as meaningful as the first one was. And it's definitely there's a buzz around the town. You know, just to be here and to see some of the things that we're seeing and to hear some of the things that we're hearing. We had a lady speak at the cookout, said she has not seen anything done in 82 years since she's been here. So there's definitely a buzz around the town. And the people in this community are excited about some of the things that are going on. And they're really looking to see what they can do to help push, you know, some of the change that they've been seeking for, some of them in a whole lifetime.
That's A.J. Bohannon. He's the founder of I Got Your Back in Wichita, Kansas, telling us about not just that first step, but those second and third steps that they're trying to take in Wichita. A.J., thanks for taking the time to talk with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about chemicals and pesticides that we encounter in our everyday life. If you're a pregnant woman or a new mom especially, are you worried about exposure from chemicals in everyday products? What other questions do you have? We have a post up on our Facebook page, Like the 21st, to join the conversation there. Or you can call us at 217-300-2121. And we're going to be talking about that tomorrow. Again, our phone number, 217-300-2121. That's our hotline where you can leave a message. All the contact information for our Facebook, everything else is at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.